Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the introduction to a new report from Just Cause about development in the Bay Area, UC Berkeley professor Richard Walker writes that, quote, San Francisco is widely considered the most gentrified city in the country, and Oakland is not far behind. The Bay Area today has more millionaires and billionaires per capita than any other big city, even New York, and upper layers of the labor force are also very well paid here. The enrichment of the upper classes is what gives gentrification such force in San Francisco and Oakland, end quote. The report, Development Without Displacement, Resisting Gentrification in the Bay Area, outlines the problems of gentrification and suggests potential solutions. The report says that community organizing, collective power building, and community self-determination must be the foundation for any strategy to prevent or reverse gentrification and displacement. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by focusing on how cities can develop without displacing longtime residents and the most vulnerable communities in the process. Today, we're joined by Maria Zamudio. She's a San Francisco housing rights organizer with Just Cause. They just released a lengthy report focusing on the impacts of gentrification and policies for stabilizing cities so long-term residents and communities of color can stay and thrive. And Maria joins me here in studio. Hi, Maria. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Sarah Karlinski, Deputy Director of SPUR, a nonprofit that promotes good planning and good government in the Bay Area. Sarah's work is focused on affordable housing and solutions to homelessness. She is the author of Smart Growth and Community Development Corporations, Putting Policy into Practice. And Sarah also joins me in studio. Hi, Sarah. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Great to have both of you. So, Maria, I want to start off with you. This is a very lengthy report. First off, how did you go about putting this together?
Yeah, so Causa Justa Just Cause has been working in the Bay Area with working class Black and Latino tenants for over 30 years. And so we see gentrification, we know it, we work against to fight evictions. And we were coming up against having policymakers asking us, well, what is it? What is gentrification? And why is it something that you all are so concerned about? And we would tell them, well, because we have X number of families that are being evicted, X number of, we see our neighborhoods changing, we see West Oakland, we see the Mission becoming really different than when we started working here, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And that still wasn't enough, right? Our policymakers, folks that are decision makers were just that. It wasn't enough. And so we partnered with the Alameda County Public Health Department, which we have partnered with them before. We partnered with them to do a report on the health impacts of foreclosures a couple years ago. And so we partnered with them again to look at the health. It started out as a report on the health impacts of displacement. So looking at how displacement stresses and displacement factors actually impact the health of a family and the health of a neighborhood. And what we ended up finding was that there was so much information, both in the stories of our members, the stories of our community members, and also in just the like demographic information that was being unearthed, that it just became this much longer report, and it became a report on displacement and gentrification instead of just the health impacts.
You said earlier that politicians were asking you questions about gentrification and what that means. So based on your findings and your work, how do you define gentrification?
Yeah, so we define gentrification really specifically as a race and class remake of a neighborhood created by the push out of working class communities of color and the while richer, more wealthier tenants are able to come in, and that increases the rents of a neighborhood. It creates incentives for displacement and evictions, and it also creates a change in the ways that investment and development happen in that neighborhood as well. So for us, it's really clear that it's about race and class. It's about a group of people being moved out so that other folks can move in.
And Sarah, you work with SPUR, and you've taken a look at this report. What are your thoughts on the main findings?
Well, I really appreciate the report. I thought it was incredibly well researched, and I learned a lot from it. One of the things that I particularly appreciated about the report was there was a lot of focus on investment and what happens when you have sort of extraordinary wealth coming to a particular area and kind of what the impacts are as a function of that wealth. I think where I might have a slightly different opinion about the report is actually having to do with new construction, with development itself, and the role that that plays.
Well, and that's the main question we're asking today, yeah. Because I live in San Francisco, and I'm just seeing so many new condos mm-hmm. being built, mm-hmm. and it's not uncommon now to hear about a two-bedroom going for like $5,500 or $6,000, sometimes more if it's mm-hmm. kind of a luxurious condo. So, I mean, this is a big question, but really important. In the case of San Francisco, Sarah, I mean, how do you develop and build all of these new condos without pushing out the most vulnerable populations?
Well, I think it's really important to think about this in the historic context. So historically, San Francisco has not built really very much housing. So over the last 20 years, we've built roughly 1,500 units a year. And what you see happening over the last 5 years, let's say, is that during the trough, as you call it, when we were in the Great Recession, we built almost no new housing. So in 2011, we built roughly 269 units of housing. I mean, virtually none. But the economy was starting to really, really heat up. And what you see actually over the last 4 years is that we've added roughly 400,000 new jobs to the region. And so what happens is when you have that extraordinary pressure that's coming from the labor market and people really wanting to live in San Francisco, and we fail to have provided sufficient housing for people to live in, then you have all the problems that Maria just described. I mean, really extraordinary problems. So you're seeing now actually the results of we did all these enormous neighborhood plans, and I'm sure you participated in those, as did I, with the Eastern Neighborhoods and Market Octavia. Now that there's sort of sufficient demand, we're now building out some of those plans. And so people are seeing kind of the combination of relatively new growth coupled with just explosive housing costs, and it's creating tremendous anxiety. The other thing I just want to mention is about Oakland. In Oakland, Oakland is seeing the spillover impacts of San Francisco's mm-hmm. extraordinary pressure, but Oakland actually hasn't added very much housing actually over the last five, six, 7 years. And so what you're seeing is actually a lot of displacement without development. And so I think that's important to think about as well.
What are your thoughts on that, Maria? First off, the fact that a city like San Francisco has not added that much housing, now that so many more people are moving here, there's demand for more.
Right. As the report clearly states, we're not against development. We think that the creation of deeply affordable, accessible housing is necessary to be able to ensure that our folks are able to stay in the city. For us, it's just about who that development is for. If the development that we are creating and investing in as a city is for new workers coming in, new higher salaried workers that are being kind of courted to come into the city, then that is going to create displacement. That is actually a setup to have the folks who currently live in neighborhoods like the Mission, like the Bayview, move out because the development and the investment in the their neighborhoods is not for them. And so for us, the kind of development that we want to see is development that is community driven, that is based in the needs of the existing residents, and that actually meets their housing demands. So, for example, there is a huge development being proposed for 16th and Mission. It's a 350 unit market rate development right there on the corner, right near the BART station. Most of those units are going to be completely unaffordable to the surrounding residents, both the rent control tenants and also the SRO tenants that live in that corner. And so what we're seeing is that 350 units in the Mission, in that 16th and Mission corridor, are very much needed. That is one of the that's one of the corners in the Mission with the highest needs for housing. However, those 350 units are not going to be accessible to the communities that are in that area, nor were they nor was the community consulted to ask, is that what they want for that plaza? That plaza is used as public space by a lot of folks that don't have the luxury of, let's say, a living room or a yard, because they are SRO tenants. They are single adults living in very small rooms. And so they use that as public space. And so for us, we're thinking about how do we make situations kind of win-win for cities, for and but but also for the existing residents of neighborhoods, right? Because when we develop for the needs of the folks that currently live in the neighborhoods, not for folks that might come in, not for folks that will come in, but for the folks that live there now, we actually see that we benefit the city as a whole, because the things that existing residents need are things that everybody needs.
So how would you have dealt with that, that new housing project that's going up at 16th and Mission?
So they're actually, along with the Eastern Neighborhoods plans and a lot of the other neighborhood plans, there were also community neighborhood plans that were written for specifically as a response to the Eastern Neighborhoods plan. There was a plan called El Plan Popular, the People's Plan, that talked about if there is going to be market rate development in our neighborhood, if there's going to be housing development in a neighborhood like the Mission that has so much pressure from the rental market, right? Like, most of the housing stock is rent-controlled housing, and that has its particular kinds of pressures because of incentives to evict, because of incentives to remove long-term rent-controlled tenants and kind of flip the buildings to make more profit. So that, on top of the pressures that are created when market rate housing comes into a neighborhood, there was a plan developed by the people of the Mission and of District 9 that says when there is market rate development, we want it to be a really clear community-based process. We want to be sitting at the table with the planners, with the developers, with the Planning Commission, and we want to name really clearly and concretely the needs that we have in our neighborhoods. And the developments should be...
And right now, that they're not at the table?
They're not, because, like, for all market rate development is at the heart of it for profit, and that's kind of part of one of the things that we find very problematic with the way that development is currently happening is that landlords, speculators, private developers, their motives are not to house people, right? Their motives are not to ensure that our neighbors are housed. Their motives are to make to make a return or to make a profit. And so if that's the motive, we're going to see that our people's needs, their basic needs for housing, are not necessarily going to be met.
So, Sarah, how should that be dealt with? The communities feel like they don't have a voice in this process. They feel like they don't have a seat at the table. And what do you get in the Mission but, I don't know, $5,500 two bedrooms?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point, and I think Maria makes some very good points. I guess I would just say if you look at the Mission and you look at the portions of the Mission that are most gentrified, there's actually been relatively little construction in those neighborhoods. So if you walk down Valencia Street or you walk down Guerrero, let's say, many of those buildings actually existing are old. And the problem is, the basic problem is that wealthy people will outcompete low-income people every single time, pretty much no matter what. And so you have to grapple with the fact that those that have more money are going to be able to kind of find the housing that they want. And that is just, it's a fact under the current structure that we live in. And so that points to sort of a different set of solutions. I mean, my boss sometimes says, look, let's just try to stack all the yuppies in concrete boxes by the water where they won't bother existing neighborhoods. And it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it's sort of accurate. And I just also want to point out that this is not just a San Francisco problem
as well.
We're
not just talking about San Francisco.
Yeah. So it's a regional problem. And so if you look at, you know, just in Mountain View, for example, Google, you know, they wanted, probably not out of the goodness of their hearts, but they wanted to build 2,000 units for their residents, and they were told by the city council, you know, no, thank you. We actually don't want you to build those particular units. And because of that, because they can't build the 2,000 units, then those 2,000, you know, employers are going to seek housing elsewhere. And so...
Why did they say no?
It's very interesting. I actually wanted to reference, there's this incredible article by a writer named Kim Mai Cutler called How Burring Owls Lead to Vomiting Anarchists, and it's on TechCrunch, and I recommend it to absolutely everyone. But what she talks about is basically they said it was for habitat protection for these burrowing owls, but I actually think it's much more of kind of a tax policy problem where jurisdictions want sales tax and they want businesses and business tax. They don't actually want to permit housing. And that's because of what happened under Prop 13. And you also write about Prop 13 in your report as well. And I think that is functionally one of the most damning problems that has vexed the state.
Prop 13.
Prop 13.
That is Sarah Karlinski. She's deputy director of SPUR, a nonprofit that promotes good planning and good government in the San Francisco Bay Area. She focuses on affordable housing and solutions to homelessness. She's the author of Smart Growth and Community Development Corporations, Putting Policy into Practice. We're also joined by Maria Zamudio, a San Francisco housing rights organizer with Just Cause. They released a 110-page report focusing on the impacts of gentrification on Bay Area communities. They also focused on policies for stabilizing our cities so long-term residents and communities of color can stay and thrive. And the report is called Development Without Displacement, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this big but very important question? How can cities develop without forcing low-income people and vulnerable communities to move out? And $70,000 is not low income, but the Chronicle had a piece recently about a city worker mm-hmm. who was kicked out of her apartment, and she can no longer afford to live in San Francisco. And I'm hearing from a lot of friends who say, if I lose my rent control, I don't know what I would do. Mm-hmm. So it's a wide swath of people who are really concerned about what would happen if they lose their current housing. So what are your thoughts on this? How has your city been affected by development? If you work for a community organization, do you feel like you have a seat at the table? What are the solutions to these problems? Because as both of our guests are saying, there hasn't been that much development in the last decade. And now, at least I know we're seeing a lot here in San Francisco. What are you seeing in your area? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you work with developers, what are your thoughts on this issue? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, yes. Good morning, Rose. I just wanted to point out that, first of all, my understanding is SPUR is a developer funded organization that has basically neoliberal beliefs in terms of park privatization and also housing. I think it's unscrupulous the way Jack Davis launched his campaign in 16th and Mission to put in these condos. And they first started with these clean up the plaza signs. And this is not going to be housing that's affordable to anyone. And the only way you're going to get affordable housing in San Francisco is if the government builds it and maintains it. Unfortunately, our housing complexes are being privatized by our Board of Supervisors, and they haven't been properly maintained. We know that's a whole other story. However, what they call affordable housing is not actually affordable to very many people, even if it's built. And all of it's being done, housing now is almost all being done just for pure profit, and even proper parking spaces aren't being built in the belief that somehow the people who can buy a $40 million condo aren't going to want to have a car. It's really poor planning, and I really wish there was an alternative voice to the people we have on the show. Thank you.
Well, we have Maria Zamudio, who's with Just Cause. They put out the report, and then Sarah Karlinski is with SPUR. Do you want to first respond to Harry's comment about funding?
Yeah,
and where
sure.
That comes from?
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm happy to talk. So anybody can go see how SPUR is funded on our website, www.spur.org. We put out an annual report. We're a member-sponsored organization. We have about 5,000 members. It's a combination of business membership and individual members. Every single week, we have new members joining, and then every single week, we have new members denouncing us because they don't like something that we've said, and that's just how it's been. I've been working there for 9 years, and I guess I could just say personally, I have extraordinary freedom to say, you know, whatever I think is right and correct, and that's what I do. So I'll just, you know, leave it at that. And do you want me to comment on the kind of the privatization?
Sure.
Because I think that's actually important. So what's going on right now is that San Francisco has roughly 6,300 units of public housing. That is housing that is owned and managed by the Housing Authority, which is a kind of a organ of the federal government. And that housing is not doing so well, so that the city, working with the mayor's office of housing, is trying to find strong nonprofit affordable housing partners and other developers of affordable housing to partner with to reinvest properly in that housing, because it's been neglected. The physical campus of those structures have been neglected for a long period of time. So I don't want anybody to think that, housing, affordable housing, is getting privatized, quote unquote. What's happening is that the city is coming up with a very appropriate and comprehensive plan for dealing with our public housing stock.
Maria? If I can just add to that, I do actually think that what our caller said about the kind of neoliberal strain of housing privatization is actually really important. And yes, there will be strong nonprofits that hopefully take on the public housing in our city and ensure that it's maintained and make sure that it is meeting all the needs of the residents that are living in there. But I think what is really important to look at is the long-term divestment in deeply affordable, highly subsidized housing that has happened from the federal government until now, right? So starting in, if we look at the increase, the spike in public housing development, and then the deep divestment from the federal government where no public housing is actually being built in the United States at all, and then we look at the ways in which the public housing that does exist is being moved out of federal kind of oversight into, yes, nonprofits, strong nonprofits, community partners, but also the private. I mean, it's still the private market in some ways. It is important to know that that is part of the cycle of kind of this neoliberal development that gentrification is a part of, right? Because we see that these communities of color that have historically been completely divested from continue to be divested from by the public by the public market, which includes our state, which includes our federal government. And then the investment that we do see in the neighborhoods, the investment that we do see in, let's say, affordable housing development is by the kind of private side of the market. And so until there's kind of a balance to that, until there's a balance between the public divestment and the private investment, we're not going to see kind of the issues that we're working on really balance out, because to have things be stabilized, to have things be deeply, deeply affordable and really accessible to working, to deeply working class folks, the private market is not going to meet that. We do need some heavy public investment.
All right. And I'd like to talk about affordable later in the show, but I want to take one more caller before we go to break because we have full lines. Let's hear from Robin in San Francisco. Hi, Robin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm really loving this show and listening to it. It's a subject that's really close to my heart. I have lived in the Mission District for 31 years. And back when they were giving buildings away in the 1980s, I bought and restored three buildings. And the reason I bought and restored them is so one of these days, I, who was a freelance, you know, writer and designer, could have a retirement. Now, I am the landlord that everybody wants. I'm a great landlord. I follow the rules. I believe in rent control. But what I'm really concerned about are two things. What's happening in San Francisco is they're driving housing out of the hands of mom and pops who just want to own a building long term, would not dream of evicting somebody, would not dream of kicking out an elderly person or a disabled person. And what happens is the laws are so draconian that instead of getting a fair retirement in 20 or 30 years, people want to profit from this, and it's wrong. And so what happens is a lot of these corporate interests who have lawyers who can afford and don't care about kicking out people or Ellis Acting buildings, they are taking over landlording. And I read a statistic recently, and I can't remember where it was, but a majority of landlords 20 or 30 years ago used to be mom and pops like me. They owned a building or two. Now they're these multinational big companies.
Well, Robin, thank you so much for your comment. We have to go to a break and then we'll get our guests to respond. Today we are talking about how cities can develop without displacing long-term residents. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard yet in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-TALK. Or you can send your question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. feedback@yourcallradio.org. Time is half past 10, coming up at 11. It's the BBC's World Have Your Say. And then at noon today, John Perry and Ken Taylor and this week's Philosophy Talk.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the proposals to reform the surveillance state in the post-Snowden era. We'll talk about a bill from Intelligence Committee Chair Mike Rogers, the White House proposal, and the USA Freedom Act, which is being embraced by civil liberties groups. So what would each of these do? Will they have teeth to change the NSA surveillance practices? And what, if anything, has changed since all of this information has been revealed? And then on Thursday, we will have a conversation about independent bookstores. May 3rd is California Bookstore Day, so tomorrow we'll be joined by independent bookstore owners, and we'd love to hear from you about how bookstores impact your life. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about how cities can develop without displacing low-income and vulnerable populations, but it's also a lot more than that. I mean, people who are making $70,000, $80,000 a year are having a tough time finding housing in cities like San Francisco. So we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this question? How do you develop without displacing long-time residents? What are you seeing in your area? And what are the solutions to these issues? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Maria Zamudio, a San Francisco housing rights organizer with Just Cause. They released a lengthy report on the impacts of gentrification and development in the Bay Area. They also include policies for stabilizing cities so long-term residents can stay and thrive. You can find the report, Development Without Displacement, on our website, yourcallradio.org. And we're joined by Sarah Karlinski, Deputy Director of SPUR, a nonprofit that promotes good planning and good government in the Bay Area. She focuses on affordable housing and solutions to homelessness. Sarah, do you want to comment on Robin's question? She's a 31-year Mission resident. She's a landlord. And she says, you know, in the old days, landlords were mom and pops, and they're not anymore. And that's a big problem.
I guess I would say I don't know that much about in terms of who is actually owning rental housing stock. I actually I have a colleague who owns a rental building in the sort of the center part of the city, and he has, I think, like 8 to 10 tenants. He seems to be – he's not going anywhere. He owns the building with his
brother. I'm sure there's a mix.
Yeah, I think there's probably a mix. I don't know, Marie, if you've studied this further.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate Robin's point because it is true. We're seeing that most property owners are now moving it used to be that your landlord, you knew where their office was. It was easy for you to call them if you needed some sort of repair. They might do it or not. It sounds like Robin is the kind of landlord that would have done it. And that was more the norm. Now we're seeing that as the real estate market in San Francisco gets hotter and hotter, we're seeing more and more speculators, people that buy a building, buy primarily rent-controlled buildings on the market, buy them very cheaply, and then flip them to make an incredible amount of profit. And they do that in less than 3 years. So a recent budget and legislative analyst report showed that a large percentage, like the majority of LSACs are happening in 3 years of a new property owner buying the building. And so we're seeing that it's very true. Speculators do not have the investment in neighborhoods that long-term property owners, mom-and-pop property owners like Robin did, that cared about the neighborhood, that cared about the well-being of the community. These are folks that are coming in, want to make as much money from an investment, right? So they see properties as investments. They see tenants in those buildings as just kind of either barriers to being able to make their complete return on their investment, or as other, you know, and the new residents that will come in, the new tenants that will come in as money signs. And we see this a lot. So we were working with a 9-unit building on 24th and Harrison that it was 9 units, all rent controlled, long-term tenants living in all of them. And the property owner bought the building less than 3 months after buying it. He sends everybody an LSAC threat. He does not intend to LSAC any of the buildings, but he sends them a threat saying that if they don't take the buyout, he's going to LSAC them all. He ends up buying everybody out eventually. It took about It took about a year to empty the building, but now it's empty. I looked on Craigslist the other day to see, because we have one family left in that building that they're not taking the buyout. And I looked on Craigslist the other day just to see how the building is going. And all of the units are four-bedroom flats, and that four-bedroom one, every single one of those four-bedroom flats is now going for $8,000.
Wow.
And it went from families paying like $1,200. So
wow. Well, we have a supervisor on the line who's been dealing with these issues. San Francisco Board of Supervisors President David Chu has been a tenant in the city for almost 20 years, and he's been working to combat the housing affordability crisis. His bill to allow the legalization of unpermitted in-law units was signed by the mayor, and his plan to give tenants evicted under the Ellis Act priority in the affordable housing unit was also implemented. Hi, Supervisor Chu. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So as you know, this is a major topic in the Bay Area, especially in San Francisco. What is the role of government here? Because in the Just Cause report, it says that the state has a central role to play in ensuring development benefits working class communities.
Well, I absolutely think that government, whether it be local, state, or federal, we do have an important role to play in partnership with our communities to make sure that we're addressing the crisis in 2014, which is our city's affordability. And San Francisco, we've always been one of the most expensive cities in the country, and as a city that's 7 by 7 miles, every time there's an economic boom, this conversation has always come up, but I do think it is entirely appropriate for those of us who are public officials to work with our San Francisco communities to ensure that the economic diversity that we love about our city remains intact, to make sure that tenants are not being pushed out of the city, to make sure that we are protecting affordable housing, as well as to make sure that we're building more housing at every level, but particularly to help our working families and our lower income communities.
And a lot more housing is being developed, and a lot of it is really expensive, as you know, two bedrooms going for about $6,000. How do you define affordable in this context?
Well, I think one of the things that's important to note is you know, we have to have a multi-pronged approach to addressing affordability. So whether it be making sure that we're standing up for tenants and legislation that I've passed to prioritize victims of Ellis Acts in our affordable housing is really important, making sure that we are providing attorneys for tenants facing evictions. And a few years ago, I passed a law that basically said that in San Francisco, we ought to provide any tenant who is low income who is facing an eviction the right to an attorney. We need to get Ellis Act reform at the state level, and today I'm introducing a resolution to support a new idea of providing tax credits for low income renters. This is a statewide idea that we need to move forward, so that's got to be part of the picture. But we also do have to build more housing, and we've had some fairly intense debates about what that entails in San Francisco, and there have been some so-called progressive constituencies that have asked us to vote against rebuilding public housing, to vote against affordable housing, and I've just disagreed with that. I think we have to make sure that we're building housing at all level, but particularly for lower-income folks and for working families, and really think hard in how we do that. In the not too distant past, we had essentially frozen housing construction in San Francisco, and I think there are some who have had the theory that really the laws of supply and demand end at our border, and I just don't agree with that. I think we have to provide more housing to provide more relief. Now, that being said, we've also had some debates about luxury condos, and as the lead champion against the so-called 8 Washington Project, this past year, you know, there are certain projects that I think only reflect housing for the extremely wealthy, and I don't think most San Franciscans support that. But we've got to not only build more housing at every level, but we have to find different ways of finding financing for that housing. And unfortunately, the state of California and Governor Jerry Brown, when he eliminated the so-called redevelopment agency a number of years ago, eliminated our ability to really have a pot of money to build affordable housing. As a city a few years ago, we passed an affordable housing trust fund to create money to do this, but we have to do more.
And we're talking with San Francisco Board of Supervisors President David Chu. And Supervisor Chu, our guests have a question for you. Sarah Karlinski is Deputy Director of SPUR.
Oh, I actually wanted to just make a comment.
Sure.
I really agree with what the supervisor is saying. And I just want to talk a little bit about your basic question when we started this was kind of how do you create an inclusive city? How do you build for everyone? And I really want to kind of go back to what Maria was talking about in terms of just the divestment from affordable housing at the state and the federal level and just how truly problematic that is. So, for example, with redevelopment, that brought in roughly $1 billion a year for affordable housing across the entire state. And now that that's gone, the state is basically putting in very little money for affordable housing. So some of the desires to build more affordable housing, permanently affordable housing, cannot be met without substantial resources. So I took a look at some of the numbers for what's in the current pipeline right now to both build affordable housing and to preserve affordable housing. I think there's roughly 1,800 units in our current pipeline that fall under that category.
For the whole state?
No, for the city of San Francisco. I apologize.
Okay. Yeah.
For the city of San Francisco. And the cost that the city estimates is, I think it's roughly like $460,000 per unit. So it's very, very, very expensive to do this. Mm. But going back to a point that Maria made about how do you house very, very low-income people? I mean, because of wage inequality, there are people who will just never be able to compete in the private market. So it is extremely important to find these resources. I think where the trouble comes in is that people, they look at kind of new construction going on now because we are in a boom. We have historically underproduced housing. And they say, you know, like, We want that housing to be affordable, and it just simply you can't make 60% of that housing affordable and have the units pencil. And so that's where we get into these just enormous clashes that I think are kind of at the heart of some of the crisis that San Francisco is experiencing.
Maria, Supervisor Chu has to go in a couple minutes. Do you have a question for him? What would you like to say about your report, and just what role do you think the government can play? And do you think that the city of San Francisco is really stepping up, supervisors especially?
I do. I think the supervisors and our local officials are taking the crisis incredibly seriously, and I really appreciate all of the work that all of the supervisors have been doing.
Supervisor, before we let you go, Maria said that a lot of grassroots organizations feel like they don't have a seat at the table. There have been a lot of discussions. I've moderated a few, and people leave really frustrated because they're not really sure what to do. They help people who are being evicted. They're going to community meetings. But it seems like there's not a dialogue between the different factions that have a role to play in all of this. So what would you say to that?
You know, I certainly think that this has been an issue in San Francisco politics in recent years, and certainly when I came into office, there was a tremendous divide and divisiveness among all of the different community stakeholders that cared about these issues. And part of what I've been trying to do is to convene meetings and bring the diverse stakeholders together who, rather than sniping at each other on radio shows and attacking each other in the pages of the Chronicle, to really sit down and brainstorm what are new and creative ideas that we can move forward on. And we have had, I think, some great breakthroughs. So after decades of a discussion about whether in-law units, which had been technically illegal in our city for decades since World War II, just this past month, the mayor signed our legislation to legalize some 40,000 in-law units that have been housing for years in a quasi-illegal context, some of our most vulnerable San Franciscans, seniors, working families, recent immigrants. And that was a breakthrough because we had tenant advocates and property owners and experts on housing like Spur sitting at the table thinking about thoughtfully how do we do this. We're actually starting another conversation about that right now in the context of shareable housing when technologies are used to allow now 100,000 visitors to come and essentially be tourists in short-term rentals that are almost akin to hotels. And what we have seen is that there are a lot of bad practices of units taken off the market to essentially be year-round Airbnb sites. Mm-hmm. And I've proposed legislation to basically say that kind of activity we don't want, but if you are a low-income working family, if you are a senior on a fixed income, if you're a student that wants to go away for a few weeks, that there be some ability to allow these practices to help make the city more affordable for those individuals? And these are difficult, nuanced conversations that we really need people to come around the table to work together to figure out how we get it done. And that's how we have breakthroughs. Last year, we decided that this long-term issue of condo conversions, where we had had thousands of San Franciscans that lived in TICs that weren't able to convert to condos, we crafted a deal that allowed a couple thousand owners of TICs to convert to condos to give them a longer-term property interest in the city. But at the same time, we created a 10-year moratorium on new condo conversions that would have led to likely hundreds of more tenants being evicted. And that those are the sorts of agreements that only come about with a lot of thoughtful people, including Maria and Sarah on this call, hashing these issues out, working together to move things forward.
All right. Well, Supervisor Chu, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That is San Francisco Board of Supervisors President David Chu. His bill to allow the legalization of unpermitted in-law units was signed by the mayor, and his plan to give tenants evicted under the Ellis Act priority in the city's affordable housing units was also implemented. And there's also an effort by State Senator Mark Leno to amend the state Ellis Act to curtail evictions. Maria, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that this might pass, and how will this affect renters?
We really do hope that it passes. It actually just passed the Housing and Transportation Committee a couple weeks ago and is going before the Judiciary Committee on May 6th. And it is one. So Ellis Act reform bills have been moved through the state, unfortunately, unsuccessfully over the past years since the Ellis Act was put into law in the 80s. And this is actually one of the first bills that we've been able to make moves in, and we've been able to move it past the different committees at the state level. And part of that is because of the energy and the kind of direct action and political will that is changing in San Francisco. And so many, I mean, when there are thousands of people in the street on a Saturday, you know, being like, the Ellis Act is not something, it's not a good policy in our state or in our city, state officials definitely listen and pay attention. What it would do is that it would ensure the Ellis Act right now is saying that if long-term landlords just don't want to be in the business of owning property anymore, and they own rent-controlled property, and for whatever reason they just can't do that anymore, they don't want to be in the business, they don't want to sell their building, but they don't want to be landlords, what they can do is they can change the use of the property by evicting the tenants and doing something else with the property. That policy was crafted to have a particular use for long-term landlords. The way that it's being utilized now is by speculators and by these corporate interests that are using it as a loophole to evict long-term rent-controlled tenants so that they can make an incredible amount of profit from flipping the properties. And like I said earlier, we're seeing that the majority of Ellis Acts are happening within 3 years of buying a property. And so the Leno bill would actually ensure that the Ellis Act cannot be used in less than 5 years of owning a property. And so it will actually create... it will actually take out a lot of the speculative uses of the Ellis Act in it.
And there's a great website, the Ellis Act. It's the anti-eviction mapping project.net. Mm-hmm. And we'll put a link on our website. We've got a number of calls, and why don't we take a few in line, and then we will get responses from Maria Zamudio, a San Francisco housing rights organizer with Just Cause, and Sarah Karlinski, deputy director of SPUR. Let's hear from Kay in San Francisco. Hi, Kay. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I can't talk nearly as fast as Maria and Sarah, but thank you, Maria and Sarah. As a teenage runaway that came with 150 others to San Francisco in 1966 and descended on the then Russian neighborhood of the Haight-Ashbury, most of those teenagers were on LSD. That completely freaked out that neighborhood. Not long after that, thousands and thousands of gay men descended upon the Scandinavian neighborhood of the Castro, which completely disrupted that neighborhood. In the very beginning, people came here for the gold rush. They come here to get rich. They come here to be who they are. They come here to escape their families. And the thing about this city is, I mean, it's never any different. What's happening now is no different than the gold rush. But we live on a fault line, and people don't know where they live. I don't know if you girls have ever been in an earthquake. We live on a fault line, and it changes everything. And no matter what anybody's involved in, you know, when that happens, or when your mayor gets assassinated, like we had an incredibly liberal, I've lived through incredibly liberal times here in the city that were horrible. Where there was housing projects all over that were like hell realms.
Well, Kay, thank you for calling, and I'll get a response in just a minute, but I want to go through a few more callers because a lot of people have been waiting patiently. So thank you. Let's go next to Susan in San Francisco. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I wanted to mention the 16th Street project again in the Mission, the Maximus Developers. People were speaking as if that's a done deal, and I think it's important for your listeners to know that it really is not a done deal. Mm-hmm. In fact, they haven't even purchased the property yet. Mm-hmm. The purchase of the property is contingent upon them getting their plans approved, and they have not yet been approved by the city. Mm-hmm. They're slated to buy that property for $25 million. It's like a parking lot and an empty dollar store. And I understand the issues about the difficulty in financing affordable housing, but it really seems to me that, what that neighborhood needs is development that meets the needs of the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. These units are going to sell, are going to rent for between $3,000 and $5,000. Mm-hmm. At least that's the plan now. It could be much more by the time it's completed.
Right. Well,
but it's not a done deal.
Okay.
If
well,
people aren't.
That's important to point out. And Maria, you can give us information about how people can speak out on this issue. Mm-hmm. We have an email from Frank who says the new apartments above the Whole Foods at Market and Dolores in San Francisco are renting $4,000 for a studio, $6,000 for a one bedroom, and $8,000 for two bedrooms. He says there's a planned condo at Market and Sanchez where the developers want to provide below market rate apartments elsewhere in the city so they can maximize the value of the units. Thank you for that email. Let's go next to Dorothy in San Francisco. Hi, Dorothy.
Hello. I'll be quick as I can. I'm a low-income senior. I've lived in a rent-controlled apartment, thank goodness, for many years. And fortunately, my situation is stable, but I've been watching this for quite a long time. One thing that strikes me is it would be awfully nice if the developers and some of these property owners understood that their investment is somebody else's survival need. Mm-hmm. That really, you know, it'd be awfully nice to be able to get them to understand that. I think that flipping should be ideally forbidden, mm-hmm. at least severely curtailed. I understand there are limitations in the works for that. And finally, what about the possibilities of refurbishing abandoned buildings, of which there are quite a goodly number in the city, mm-hmm. to make affordable housing? That should be cheaper than doing it from scratch.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's hear from Julian in San Francisco. Hi, Julian.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Sure. Go ahead.
First of all, I think this is a really important discussion, and thank you for bringing it to your show. My question is for both guests, particularly what do they believe the role of affordable housing policies, specifically that of rent control itself, play in the gentrification process, and how they put an artificial cap on new development by distorting market forces and restricting new supply that could help meet some of the housing demand.
All right. Well, thank you for calling. We have a sort of a related email from Laurel, who's a landlord. She says almost every one of her tenants earns so much than she does. She writes, that's okay, but over the years, I'm subsidizing them. I have one nine-year-long tenant who pays $1,400 for a two-bedroom, and I know he earns millions from Google. Good for him. I want rent control, but I think tenants should at least get certified like they're a teacher, or they earn less than $100,000 a year. Why am I subsidizing my Google tenant? He's a great guy, but this kind of arrangement will eventually lead me to selling the building that I love in Bernal Heights, which I will have to leave. Want to comment on that?
Sure. I'd be happy to. I mean, I think that, you know, Spur has historically stayed out of the rent control discussion because for a variety of reasons, but we've really wanted to focus on increasing the supply at all income levels. But I will just say that, you know, there's roughly 230,000 units of rental housing. Roughly 75% of those are rent controlled. And there are multiple different ways to look at this. I mean, one way to look at it is, you know, we haven't means tested tenants. I've heard stories like the one that Julian mentioned and others have mentioned about relatively wealthy tenants. But I will say in a city like San Francisco, when it's so difficult to add supply, rent control is actually, I think, very important. And one of the points that we make, and I failed to mention this, and I really should, we recently came out with a report called It's Not Too Late to Make San Francisco Affordable Again. It's available on our website. And one of the first things that we talk about is protecting the existing rental housing stock. And a portion of that is rent control. But I do think that in order to solve the problem overall, and I believe it was Julian that mentioned this, we do need to look at ways of increasing the supply at all income levels.
And we have about a minute left. We had Dorothy called about turning abandoned buildings into affordable housing. Maria, in all the research you did, where are you seeing this work? Can you give us an example of a city that's doing this right, in your opinion?
Yeah, so there are actually, so there are a lot of cities that, well, not a ton of cities, but there are ways in which folks in Oakland and San Francisco, if we look locally, where we are taking housing off the market. And so I think the points that are brought up about how rent-controlled housing is creating a subsidized situation for some folks or others actually gets to the core of the fact that we have something that is a human right, a basic need, that is being commodified. So that is going to create an incredible amount of inequality. It's going to make one person unhappy if the other one is doing well and, you know, vice versa. And so part of it is rent control is incredibly important to fighting gentrification. It keeps community stabilized. It creates an option for deeply affordable housing for folks to be able to have. And it also begins to show that housing is not, should not be a commodity bought and sold to the highest seller, because super low income folks will never be able to compete at the same rate. And so we need to have alternatives like housing trust funds, like housing co-ops, things that begin taking housing off the market, that begin taking land off the market, so that they are actually a community benefit, a community resource, and not just controlled by a few for the profit.
Maria Zamudio is a San Francisco housing rights organizer with Just Cause. You can read their report, Development Without Displacement, on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Sarah Karlinski is deputy director of SPUR. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for all of your emails and phone calls. Sorry we didn't get to all of you. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What are the proposals to reform the surveillance state in the post-Snowden era? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the competing proposals for NSA reform on Capitol Hill, a bill from Intelligence Committee Chair Mike Rogers, the White House proposal, and the USA Freedom Act, and that's being embraced by civil liberties groups. So what would each of these do, and will they have the teeth to really change the NSA's surveillance practices? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.